is KHOI Community Radio's Local Talk Wednesday edition of COVID-19 Response. I'm one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with Pat Schlarbaum, who really keeps the daily programming going during this health crisis. It's amazing just how many individuals and organizations right here in central Iowa are responding. Thanks for being here again, Pat.
Well, I'm glad to be here. This vital programming, keeping KHOI on the air. But even I am surprised at just how much is going on in central Iowa. There is so much important information to keep people safe, help our neighbors, and keeping our spirits up while sheltering at home.
And we appreciate the conversations about the natural world you have on Wednesdays.
Yes, we have another installment from Carolyn Raffensperger.
I'm Carolyn Raffensperger, and I work for the Science and Environmental Health Network, and I'm a member of the community of Ames and Story County and Iowa and this continent and this planet.
You've been a contributor to our COVID-19 special reports.
I have. Yours and my conversation has been a part of the report.
Yes.
And I think that what the two of us bring is a view on ecology and the environment, situating the virus and the illness and pandemic that has stricken humanity across the globe, and understanding how it fits within that larger ecology.
Yeah, I think we always thought that there might be a challenge like this, and we're certainly in the middle of it now.
We are, and I think many of us had been lulled into complacency. We thought we had vaccines for the major viruses and other things that had been plagues, and that, yeah, we were going to get the flu, but that most of the illnesses that humanity has faced, or now, or in the United States, are chronic. So the chronic illnesses of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and things like that have taken over as the number one causes of death in the United States. I began my environmental career, I worked for the Sierra Club years ago, and got a taste of all the range of environmental issues, from national forest management plans, gravel mining in a gorgeous fen called Bluff Spring Fen in Elgin, Illinois, or pollution of the Mississippi River, things like that, you know, and I understood a range of issues. When I came to work for the Science and Environmental Health Network, we began understanding how the chemicals that we use in our daily lives and not so daily lives, pesticides on crops in Iowa or in our gardens, plastic, the range of chemicals that are human-made and that do not occur in nature, and how they were affecting human biology. And we began to understand that many of those chemicals that are based on fossil fuels and human-made, do not occur in nature, actually act like hormones in the body. And the warnings that we began to issue were, you're going to see more developmental disabilities among children. You will see more reproductive disorders in both men and women. You will begin to see a range of diseases that will not manifest instantly. So the pandemic, you know, if you get the virus within 2 weeks, you know it. But if you have been harmed by a chemical, a toxic chemical, it may not show up until you are much older. And in some cases, the chemicals that taught us these hard lessons about acting like hormones were given to mothers when they were pregnant, and their grandchildren are showing the effects of that chemical. Those kinds of timescales are very difficult for humans to understand and to act and prevent harm. And I think that the pandemic has been teaching us a lot of lessons. First, I think we somewhere between sourdough starter, which is a yeast, wild yeast that will grow in flour and water if you nurture it, and you can use it to bake bread or make pancakes instead of yeast that you buy in the store. And that our world is filled with microbes, filled with them. And this one virus has taught us more about microbes, along with sourdough starter, that people are using because they can't get yeast anymore, about that unseen world. What I was thinking about this morning was the gift of ecologists, and that is for us to think in systems. And the systems of how diseases move, the consequences of shutting down the United States, essentially, and having us in self-isolation, what are the consequences of all of those? And ecologists think in systems. What happens if you don't have a pollinator? You don't get fruit. And the number of things that we eat, the number of wild plants that are essential for a whole forest or prairie that are dependent on pollinators. And the ecologists taught us to think in those kinds of systems. Engineers do too. But in terms of how living things live together and how you maintain health in either the ecosystem or in our own bodies, our bodies are an ecology. We know that people respond to the virus differently depending on a whole set of factors. You know, do you have a good diet? Do you have enough exercise? Are you under stress? How old are you? That your body is different based on a whole lot of things than the body next to you. So the ecologist taught us that. And I thought, you know, you've learned more about ecology. You are an ecologist. And I wondered what you had learned about the ecology from the birds that you tried to restore.
Well, there you've really entered into a world of insight, if you will. Birds right now aren't coming to mind, but there have been deformities noted in the reproductive tracts of frogs. Things that are water-loving are beginning to exhibit deformities that are not natural. And if I think about birds, but offhand, other than the DDT that was ravaging the countryside in the 1950s and 60s, creating a biocide, if you will, was pretty apparent. The birds definitely were able to exhibit elements in nature that were counter to the system of the natural law and order of things.
So what we did with DDT was used it to kill mosquitoes primarily. And DDT is a chlorinated compound. And what happened was it was so ubiquitous in the environment. And it is one of those chemicals that acts like a hormone. And what happened was, as I understand it, the birds that ingested were exposed to DDT. It interfered with their calcium metabolism. And the shells became too soft to support the bird's weight, and the eggshells were crushed, meaning that it couldn't reproduce. Their babies couldn't survive those too soft eggshells.
That was exactly right.
And what happened then is if you kill those large birds, the eagles, the hawks, and others, and so we've affected the environment, and when you take down those big predators, the cascade is then you get more rodents, you get more small animals, which can also carry diseases that can cross into humans. So when you disturb that environment, there's a cascade of effects that will also come back to haunt us.
And that, you know, I just thought of one that maybe I can include. The Lyme disease that came out of the East Coast in Connecticut was it was through the ticks, but it also was hosted in the mice and the deer. And they looked at what's going on with the mice? How come their populations were blossoming? And there was a very profound study that concluded that because, one thing, there were more acorns, and deer mice love acorns. And thought, well, why are there more acorns? And it turns out it was the passenger pigeons that would come through, literally darken the sky for days, and they ate a lot of acorns. And in the absence of the passenger pigeon, because it went extinct back in the 1890s, early part of the 20th century, just an incredible loss of wildlife. But the impacts were in the absence of the passenger pigeons that would have been eating up most of these available acorns, that all that food source was there for the mice, and then ultimately the ticks, and then ultimately the Lyme disease in humans.
Yes. And I wanted to go back to the frogs that you mentioned. Not only the frogs have had deformed limbs and others, and they're really a sentinel species, a species that is out ahead of the curve. They're the ones who are going to tell us about problems in water, because they're both water and land critters, and they're tadpoles or water. And so when you start to see a problem in a frog, you've got a really important warning for humans, because our babies are, you know, 9 months in a watery environment, and the frogs tell us a key story. And if you are listening to this as part of your school assignment in high school, I want to tell you about citizen science. And that is that children, kids, on a grade school or high school field trip in Minnesota were the first ones to discover deformed frogs because of water pollution. And the citizen science are people who are not necessarily trained experts, but may have an avid fondness and ability for some species or for a place, and are able to make regular observations and record information that is data. And one of the most famous of the citizen science projects, and by citizen I don't mean of a country, I mean of a place. I am a citizen of the Tallgrass Prairie. That the bird counts run by Audubon, isn't that right?
Yes, the Christmas bird counts.
The Christmas bird counts. And those are some of the best data that we have for knowing how many birds there are. So a point I wanted to make about disease is that we thought that most of the diseases were going to be slow building. Chronic diseases based on diet or, you know, problem diets, too much food, not adequate nutrition, or that they were based on these toxic chemicals. Both of those are slow moving. And what we are discovering is because we have altered the ecology, we are now also going to see these very fast moving diseases that are infectious. And all of these can be traced to what humans have done to their environment. Famous scientist named René Dubos said that every civilization or society creates the conditions for the diseases it has. And what we need to know and understand is that we created the conditions for this pandemic by the way that we raised food, the way we moved food around, the way we moved around the planet. This disease would not have moved so quickly to the United States or all of the other countries, Europe and the other countries, if we did not have the kind of rapid travel that we have now. Mm-hmm. So we have created the conditions for the diseases that we have. And every civilization, every society creates the conditions for the diseases it has. And the ecologist tells us that if we live in a right relationship with the earth, we are much more likely to live in health. If the world around us is healthy, we are much more likely to be healthy. And it seems to me that the ecologist, in addition to giving us the basic principles for what health really is, they also give us the warnings when they start to see problems in the natural world, whether it's frogs that are deformed or have reproductive disorders, whether it's the birds that Rachel Carson said we're going to have a silent spring if we kept using DDT because the birds would not sing. If we did not hear that bird song, we had to heed those warnings. So the first thing that they do is they give us those warnings about what is wrong in the earth with this place that we live, and how if we don't mend our ways, we will suffer from a fate that is actually preventable. And the second thing that I think that ecologists do, and this is one of the things that I want to give honor to all of those who have been talking about rewilding the earth or who've been talking about how these systems fit together and how we owe it to future generations of all beings to protect it. And that is that they bear witness. You know, there Jungian psychologists talk about archetypes, that we have these underlying archetypes in our cultures. You know, so one that's in the United States is, you know, that cowboy, that the independent, exploring, the guy who can, you know, travel long distances on those, you know, cattle herding. And the cowboy is one archetype, or the king, or the court jester, the hero. But it seems to me that one that we have missed is the witness. That the witness, the one who bears witness and tells the truth to bring justice about. And the ecologists have been telling us, we are destroying the earth. We are destroying the climate. We are making the climate so unstable that it's going to be hard to live here if we don't stop it. We are destroying all of our fellow creatures, whether it's the birds or whether it's the water creatures. And we owe it to the earth and to future generations to mend our ways. And I think that that bearing witness, looking at it, telling the truth, calling out that warning, is an extraordinary gift that we've been given by ecologists. And we have been given the warning with this pandemic about how we raise food, about how we treat our earth. And right now in Iowa, we are witnessing, and I use that word again, witnessing what's happening at our food packing plants. We are witnessing what is happening to our farmers who have too many pigs, too much manure, no place for the hogs to go, no place for the manure to go except in our water. We will poison the water if we keep doing this. We will poison the workers if we keep doing this, and we don't have to. We can change this. We can raise our food in a way that is healthy for the land, that is healthy for the water, that is healthy for the worker, and that is healthy for us. And it is our obligation to do this. So I want to honor those ecologists among us who have been telling this story, issuing those warnings, and bearing witness.
Well, thank you for what you're bringing to the conversation, Carolyn Raffensperger. You are certainly a citizen scientist of the natural world.
For those who have just tuned in, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We've just heard a conversation between Pat Schlarbaum and Carolyn Raffensperger about ecological change. Thank you, Carolyn and Pat, for starting Local Talk Wednesday on a contemplative note. And this is also a very appropriate subject as we consider the news stories about the coronavirus and meatpacking plants in Iowa. For this exploration, I'm happy that we're joined by our farm reporter, Gina McAndrews, to talk with our guests about some very big issues.
We certainly have some quite distinguished guests today. We've got Chris Peterson, Aaron Lehman, John Gilbert. All of them have been lifetime farmers that are specializing in different foods. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Before we begin, I'd like to ask you to introduce yourselves.
I'm Chris Peterson. I farm near Clear Lake, Iowa, and farm for all my life. I'm 65 years old. Raised everything, crops, livestock. Last 25 years, I've become very vocal in the direction of agriculture, looking for ways and picking on politicians to keep the independent family farm in business to feed this country like we did for over 200 years, and then agribusiness came along and monopolized everything and changed everything, and here we are, you know, with a pandemic and lots of problems.
Before we move on, I might mention that you were very active in the fight against the prestige plant up near Clear Lake. It's now over by Eagle Grove. And you raise a lot of hogs in the traditional way. Let's move on now. Aaron Lehman, the president of the Farmers Union.
I'm a farmer from just between Ames and Des Moines, just outside of Allaman. We grow corn, soybeans, oats, and hay in our farm here.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about the way you grow it?
Sure. We grow our crops both conventionally and about half in an organic rotation as well. We grow our conventional soybeans, our non-GMO soybeans that go to a specialized market there.
Gina, you can see all these people as well as I can.
Hello, John Gilbert. Can you tell us about yourself?
Sure. I've farmed for more years than I want to admit in Hardin County. We're kind of in that area where the hog confinements originated and are quite thick. We've been active with the local watershed groups and with a number of other organizations, but our farm has been in the family going back several generations, and we're the county's last dairy farm. We milk about between 50 and 60 Brown Swiss. We've raised pigs in a humane, antibiotic-free manner for a number of years. We've been selling to Nyman Ranch for over 20 years, I guess. So we've got three family members involved, and we've got one full-time and two part-time employees, and we're the total farm is a little less than 800 acres.
Now that you've all introduced yourselves, I would like to talk a little about the impetus for inviting you here today. There was a story in last Friday's Des Moines Register about the closing of the Tyson pork plant in Columbus Junction. The story began with an account of a worker who had contracted coronavirus and had recovered, but he was in extreme pain. It was a very unpleasant experience. And when he had recovered, he went back to work. But he knew other people who had died from it. That's a fact of life now among the workers at the Tyson pork plant. And as I have also learned just today, workers are now frontline workers, and they cannot stay home when sick, or they will be denied their unemployment benefits. But Tyson had built up goodwill in the town by providing scholarships for some of the workers' children, and training for other skills for some of the workers.
Yeah, we'll talk a lot about the traditional ways of raising hogs and how the Tyson plants are in the news. There's a lot of cases of COVID. And as we saw yesterday, the president has announced he was using the Defense Production Act to reopen them. So that we wouldn't interrupt the meat supply for the country. But at the same time, there's a lot of people getting sick, as we just talked about. And also, these people don't have the masks and PPE that are needed to work in those conditions. And so we wanted to discuss today, what are some alternatives to raising hogs, and how can we change the system that's been embedded? Chris, do you want to lead us off?
Yeah. You know, I've farmed since the early 70s, and I grew up in the 60s, so I don't want to say anything that's offensive, but we had something that worked very well during those times. It was called family farm agriculture. It was spread out. We had independent family farms raising livestock in very sustainable way. We sold into a bidded market, a supply and demand market. And what we sold into was regionalized packing plants spread across the landscape. Probably within a 100-mile radius where I live, there was 8, 9, 10 packing plants. They were smaller packing plants, not these humongous things we have today. And we had regionalized labels like Dubuque Pack and Deckers here in Mesa City, Hormel in Austin, Minnesota. There was plants in Marshalltown. There was plants in Waterloo, all over the map. And you had the Packers couldn't own livestock back in those days. And we had people running around the countryside, buyers, they were called, for the Packers. And they'd stop at the family farms or call you and wanting to know if you had any pigs to sell. And that worked very good. So it kept family farmers in business. It kept people employed. It was national security proof. You know, an enemy couldn't bring down agriculture as it was at that time. And it was basically pandemic proof. This is something we don't have today. You know, big is better was the theory, and get rid of the family farms. And here we are. It hasn't worked.
I believe that started changing in the 80s when President Reagan then changed the Packers and Stockyards regulations that prohibited Packers from owning livestock, which is now they own hundreds of thousands and has leaded into this problem. John, do you want to tell us of some other methods that you've been doing?
Sure. You know, we have raised pigs more or less the same way that, you know, I grew up. You know, we do not use any confinements. We do have a hoop, but mainly we're trying to let the pigs develop their own good natural immunity from exposure to the environment. And, you know, we're sitting in the middle of, you know, one of the highest concentrations of you know, pigs in probably in the country, if not the world. And the only way we can keep our herd healthy, because we are antibiotic free, is with sunshine and fresh air. And so that's the system that we've relied on. And fortunately, we were able to, you know, develop a long-term relationship with a market that has proved to be very, very beneficial for us. And right now is, you know, wanting and taking all the pigs that we can supply them.
What do you see as some ways we can start changing the system that's evolved?
Well, one of the big things I think that we need to do is realize that to rebuild the food system that is, you know, is good in good times and bad, is it's going to have to come from the ground up, from the grassroots level up. It's got to be driven by consumers. It's got to be facilitated by, you know, community action. It can't come from the top down. You know, I think we're at a point now where everybody can understand the argument that food is no longer something that can be left just to business. It's going to be considered a national and a community security thing. And I think it's very much, you know, a lot of communities are going to have to see their food supply in the same way that they see fire and police protection and public health and public education. It's going to be something that is going to require some public involvement, not necessarily to replace, you know, the role of business, but to facilitate, because we can produce an immense amount of food in Iowa. We can produce it safely. We can produce it in a way that employs a lot of people, and we can do it, you know, in much better ways than we currently do. But the people that are doing it need to be able to have a life of security and be able to make a living at it and be able to do it with dignity. And I think right now, you know, many of the people who are doing alternative foods are struggling. And, you know, there's going to have to be a lot of community involvement to figure out a system that works. But, you know, that kind of system is not going to come from the top down. But I do know one of the things that will have to change, and that is the requirements and rules on smaller meat processors, because my understanding is that even your local locker's got to meet the same standards that the big IP, that the big packer plants have to. And I think that's wrong, because, you know, local communities can figure out what the right standards are to help, you know, a local business. And, you know, if they're not meeting those standards, they won't buy the product and the business will go out. But Right now, I think one of the big things that we need to take away from the current situation is that this is a man-made situation. We were told, you know, in the 80s and the 90s that you folks who are raising on a family farm method are not efficient. You need to specialize. You need to get big. You need to get out. If you can't do that, you can't get out. If you can't get your cost of production down, you need to get out. Well, quite frankly, these big people need to be told the same thing. You created this mess. You do not need taxpayer money to prop you up. And, you know, you've got to sort this mess out yourself. And if you want to know how to improve the situation, that's where you start. You don't keep propping up a failed system.
I think we should get a lot of the community members involved. I mean, all they care about is that they get food at a reasonable price, a lot of them. You know, kind of like the fire department that you mentioned. Aaron, do you have some ideas with that, what you guys are doing with the Farmers Union?
Well, I think you have to look at both the current situation and people who are in very dire circumstances and expect that we're going to have some short-term help for people who are under really, really intense economic pressure. But we can't forget that while we do that, we have to look at the entire food system picture. And that means that we, while we're looking to feed people who have an immediate need, that we're also demanding that changes be made to the system. So we're encouraging people to connect with local farmers as much as they possibly can for their food needs, to give generously to people in our community who are food insecure, but at the same time demand those safeguards and protections so that farmers and consumers aren't preyed upon by agribusinesses that dominate the food chain now. So yes, we need to meet our immediate needs and provide affordable, safe food, but at the same time we need to demand changes. And we can't do one while neglecting the other.
Do we have ideas on what these changes should be? I mean, how do we get that started? I mean, we can talk all we want to that the big businesses are bad and the farmers are efficient, but how does that really get to happening? Cornelia has some ideas.
Cornelia, yeah.
Well, I'm just going to say that one of the things we have to look at is the rules and regulations that both of you or all of you have pointed out. I was studying what was happening to agriculture in the 70s and early 80s in both Argentina and the U.S. And it was the same thing, the centralization of the food system, the taking away of local control. Also seeing how people were organizing against it, but how that was not as effective. The whole point was this odd measure of efficiency that it is how much money do you put in and how much money do you get out, and efficiency for whom? But those rules like the Packers rules were set by, and I had a student do a dissertation on standards, and standards in the packing industry were determined by the very large packing plants, the Tysons, the Smithfields. So if you didn't have your drinking fountain a certain distance from the kill floor, you could. Now you have a small locker plant, that distance, it makes no sense. But those were ways that we were able to de-establish the locker plants that used to be in almost every community and now have everything hugely centralized. And I say this as someone who has a freezer full of half a hog and a quarter of beef I got from local farmers, because I'm lucky enough to be able to do that. But a whole lot of people aren't. And so I think we have to go back, and as Chris said, this is a system that has been set up basically to channel the profit outward. And so we run hog hotels in Iowa at great externalities to our water and our soil.
Excuse me, I'm going to jump in because we just heard from Cornelia Flora, who is coming on for the last segment. And So she hasn't been introduced yet, and she is a professor of agricultural sociology and obviously has had a great deal of experience. So we'll be hearing from her later a little more about how this system developed historically. But is there anything else that anyone wants to say before we wrap up this segment?
Yeah, Ms. Griff, what I'd like to say is I think we're missing something here. What we need to get the money, the lobbying out of politics. We need to get the campaign money out of politics. So all of our elected officials start to think straight again. Instead of thinking about, oh, I need to get reelected, I need to do this, I need to do that. It impacts policy big time of what's going on. That's one of the main reasons we got to where we're at. Big agribusiness, big corporations seem to have far, far, far more influence in the political landscape, and things happen. And it comes down to writing farm bills, or comes down to policy. And I'm not just talking about the federal level, I'm talking about state level, such as local control. So we need to get the money out. You know, that's my message. And then we can start to reform agriculture along with our public officials, you know, the senators, House members, whatever, bureaucrats. We need a system back to feed America.
Susan, Aaron Lehman has some closing remarks.
All I wanted to mention is that we really want to encourage people to, in addition to meeting their current needs as best as possible, do their best to connect with local farmers, is to demand those infrastructure changes that are farmer-led, that close the gap between family-sized farmers and consumers. And I think what we're going to see in the next few days, even while we're demanding that our plants stay open, that they're going to probably be bailed out for the cost of doing that. And at the same time, instead of propping up that infrastructure, we also need to talk about real infrastructure changes that connect farmers to consumers more directly. So I thank you so much, though, for bringing up this discussion. It's a very important one, and one that will need to continue in the future. So thank you so much, Susan.
Yeah, we look forward to hearing you all again at some time, and your suggestions for more guests to carry this in many new ways. Thanks. Thanks very much.
I will just say, in closing that, I think there is signs of encouragement. If nothing else, people have had, I think, a chance to get a different attitude about food because, half the food used to be eaten away from home, and now it's primarily being eaten in the home. But, you look at anecdotally the demand for freezers. I'm told there's big waiting lists at most appliance dealers. Some of the hatcheries can't keep up with chicks. Vegetable seeds are a hot commodity. These are all signs that people are changing their attitudes about food. And I find that to be, extremely encouraging. And so, how long lasting it'll all be is yet to be determined. But I think there are signs that people's opinion and how they consider food has changed.
Let's have a short music break.
Yes, we've got a Big Blue Sky, Down to the River.
We bought a little cabin south of town, right on the river where it bends around. South of town where the river bends, down to the river again, down to the river, down to the river, south of town where where the river bends down to the river again. We got an old dog, she moves like a bear. She's got one foot in the grave, but she loves it there. She's a city dog with a second wind down to the river again. Down to the river. Down to the river. She's a city dog, she got a second wind down to the river again. You know, it's nice to see my woman smile. She lost a dream and it's been a while. You know, it seems to me like she's always been there. Down to the river again.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we've been talking with Aaron Lehman, John Gilbert from the Iowa Farmers Union, and also with Chris Peterson, and about the future directions of her agriculture and what we can all do to change this system. Our last guest will be giving us a story about how we got here. We've already heard a little book from her, Cornelia Flora, a Charles F. Curtis Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Agriculture and Life Sciences at Iowa State University. She studied agricultural communities throughout the world and brings a unique vision of how the business of agriculture developed in America. Thanks for being with us, Cornelia.
It's a pleasure to be here, and you've had three of my favorite farmers talking, so it's very exciting. And each of them mentioned things from the past and how they have been sharply changed. But I wanted to start out going way back, remembering that we're a settler society in the Americas, and the people who came over wanted, on the one hand, they wanted land and opportunity. On the other hand, the people that sent them over were looking for cheap inputs for industry. So in early on in the colonies, we grew tobacco to ship to England, we grew cotton to ship to England, and we got shipped back cloth. That the notion was what we had to offer was something that was we would then buy back from them. But as we moved west on what was viewed as free land, we had people who weren't really interested in simply shipping stuff back to the mother country. And people, as they moved to the frontier, I think not even realizing that land belonged to other people who had made a living on that land for millennia, set up ways to be collectively independent. Some of the first things that they did as they came to people came to Iowa was organize themselves. They built a church, they built a school, and they taxed themselves to pay for them. The other thing that they did was set up self-sufficient food systems. So you had very diverse farms. And here in Iowa, we can't grow all around, but we can grow a whole lot of stuff. And we learned how to preserve what we grew in the summer to have when we were in the winter. We learned when we slaughter and how we can keep it, our meat fresh over the winter so we can use it in the summer. And that notion of self-sufficiency, what internationally we called import substitution, which was a policy before the 1980s, the development policy was input substitution. That why import it if you can do it here? But that changed very swiftly. We moved to the neoliberal model of comparative advantage. So that instead of having a diverse, self-sufficient economy for a nation or a state or a region, we moved to what is your comparative advantage? And it was defined for us, not necessarily by Iowans. Our comparative advantage was raising high value, low volume products like corn and soybeans. And then it was discovered that we also could do something else very cheaply on a scale, and scale was viewed as really good. The bigger you are, the better you are. Get big or get out. So we found, again, and mentioned, this is important of the point that was made about the Packers and Stockers Act, that when you could have the animal owned all the way through the food system, you began to have this huge concentration. And with this, and this is when we saw farmers getting organized, and I was mentioning the same thing was going on all over the world with the centralization of food, and farmers saying, no, we don't want this, we don't like it. And the rules being changed in such a way, it was impossible to really fight back to keep self-sufficient, or at least systems that work locally as well as fed the nation. So we had this incredible concentration, the decline of the number of farms, the increase in the outside ownership of both land and animals, that led to something that where the externalities, as I mentioned, such as water and soil, were simply not mentioned, nor was human health. And in order to make these systems work, and we've always had people who moved around to help with agriculture. The threshing bees, during harvest time, you used to have harvesters who would travel up and down the center of the United States to harvest. And they were viewed as an important part of the community. And women were very important in keeping things going because you had to serve your threshers and harvesters food. But then we figured out if we get really big machines and own them through credit, you can have these. So the other thing we saw going on was a concentration and loss of local banks. And this occurred a bit during the Depression, but occurred a lot more during the 1980s. So we saw these huge changes in the infrastructure that allowed local enterprises to thrive and still feed the nation. And we began to say, no, we feed the world. And when he was Secretary of Agriculture, Bill Sack said, no, we don't really raise food in Iowa, we raise industrial inputs. And I think this, we've even viewed now that the animals we raise have become industrial inputs. And the industry is run by a second comparative advantage, which are low-wage packing plant workers who are under very unsafe conditions. So now we're having farmers saying, you've got to keep those packing plants open or we'll have to slaughter all these animals and compost them, versus people saying, I risk my life by working. And the companies are just simply not, that are owned by someone in China or someone in Brazil or someone sitting in New York City. And what happens to the workers is not of much concern, nor is what happens to the farmers. What's important, the one measure we have is stockholder value and quarterly profits, which presumably were related. And the only good thing that's happening with all of this is that all those multinational corporations who use their big tax cuts to buy back their stock are in serious trouble now. But unless we pay attention, and as Chris said, we start from what our policies are and who makes those policies and what money is influencing those policies down to the consumers, about being aware of what we eat, where it comes from, and all those externalities around it. And also, what are other ways of distributing the food that farmers grow All of these have to be taken into account as we move toward what we hope will be a more sustainable system that will be better for the land, more diverse, more caring, less damage, better for farmers who are able to make a living with dignity, better for the worker to take that food and process it, move it forward, and ultimately better for consumers who will have assured food supplies that are not dependent on one huge value chain, but on lots of small ones. Because the reason that we're having so much trouble now, for example, with meat, is because we have such a small, controlled value chain for providing the meat to the consumers. So I think that our free farmers pointed that out very well. We can have alternatives. There are some that have been established, but we have to look at policy. We have to look at what people's individual choices are, but what are our collective choices? And this goes back to what the notion of state rules as well as federal rules. When the government decided, the state of Iowa decided that no, we couldn't have local control. Counties could not make decisions about the siting of animal feeding operations, CAFOs. When we centralized it, we then came down to the wrong set of measures of what we do and why we do it. One other thing that I think Chris mentioned, that those buyers used to come around to look at farms, are no longer there, because of course, when you're buying hogs on CAFOs, the hogs don't belong to the farmer anyway. The farmer has invested in all the infrastructure that allows them to have so many animals in such a small space. And Iowa State was helpful in that, because we bred hogs with flat hooves rather than those pointy hooves that hogs evolved with that allowed them to dig for the stuff they like, all the roots in the ground. And we lost the sale barns where people used to take their animals, where the buyers would come around. You would know your buyer. Your buyer would know the market. We lost all the relationships, and our only measure is short-term profit.
Thank you, Cornelia. That gives us a good idea of where we've been and a basis for where we're going. This is KHOI, Community Radio, and you have been listening to Local Talk with hosts Susan Franzen, Pat Schlarbaum, and Gina McAndrews. Today's guests were Carolyn Raffensperger, Chris Peterson, Aaron Lehman, John Gilbert, and Cornelia Flora.
Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m. At noon today, Local Talk will present a special program from Ames Public Library to brighten your spirits and those of any children who might be living with you. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories.
Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard, Pat?
Oh, that was Down by the River with Dave Moore and the Big Blue Sky. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, please contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. Just look for the yellow Become a Member Donor button.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI meaningful and possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.